From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's sports program, Only a Game. Thank you. Thank you very much. We've got a great show for you today. Former Major League pitcher Barry Zito is waiting in the wings. He's going to talk about his life in music and baseball and music. But first, Devo. They'll be coming on and paying a tribute to beloved golfer Chichi Rodriguez. And our last act, coming all the way from Stockholm, Sweden. Hello, Stockholm. You don't want to miss this one, folks. Music and sports today on Only a Game. Don't leave your seats. The show is about to begin. A while ago, we happened upon an unlikely bit of sports lore in an equally unlikely place, the annals of avant-garde art rock. You might remember the band Devo, best known for their 1980 hit Whip It, and for appearing in hats that looked like flower pots and yellow hazmat suits. They were weird. More weird is the story of how an equally colorful athlete became a kind of mascot for the band, reporter Sean Cole explains.
To understand what happened, you need to know that Devo has a pretty considered philosophy, and that is that the human race is in a state of de-evolution, hence the name of the band. Their songs are about things like corporate control and blind conformity, and they were visual artists first, before they even wrote any songs. This was in the early 70s in Akron, Ohio. So one of the founders, Jerry Casale, says they were always trying to figure out what devolved art would look like.
You know, because we were very, very enamored and put off at the same time by pop culture, like the lowest end of like ad graphics, terrible TV commercials. So we're walking through the Kmart.
Nope, it was the predecessor to Kmart. It was Click.
This is Mark Mothersbaugh, another founder of the band. I should probably mention here that this was more than four decades ago, so a lot of the details are fuzzy for folks. Anyway, they're in the department store.
We were looking for supplies. We were collaborating on a visual art piece together and walking through the sports section.
And there's these six practice golf balls in a clear plastic pouch, sealed shut at the top with a cardboard display head.
The kind that you hang on a metal hook. And on that display head is an illustration of the smiling face of the renowned golfer Chichi Rodriguez.
I saw it and I just loved it. It was a picture of him in front of a golf ball.
So his head's kind of haloed by a big golf ball.
Kind of imitating something that I'd already been printing, which was human heads in front of the moon. And it made us laugh.
We chuckle. We have to have that. And of course, golf was almost symbolically like the most lame kind of, you know, bourgeois pursuit that you could have, especially at that time. Unless your parents were rich, you didn't get to go golfing.
If we ever imagined ourselves on a golf course, it was probably as a caddy.
And how boring it looked then on TV and the announcing.
Yeah.
But the one guy who stood out was Chichi because he didn't fit with the rest of the golfers at all. He wore these loud pants and bright shirts, and he had this famous hat that only he wore, which had a specific hat band and, you know,
the Panama hat,
straw yeah. Panama kind of hat. Yeah.
So they took the package home. Mark used the picture in a self-published manifesto he was writing about being a quote-unquote spud boy in the rubber town of Akron. But other than that,
nothing really happened with it until we were already putting out our self-produced single, Be Stiff. Somehow, and I don't really remember the moment, but we had the idea of putting Chichi on that cover.
On the cover of the 45. Be Stiff was a kind of jokey anthem, celebrating the literal stiffness, uptightness of politicians, televangelists. So using that image of Chichi on the cover was a kind of comment on commercialism and America's obsession with selling.
And in this case, selling plastic golf balls and the Americana of the golfer.
Be Stiff came out in 1978 on Stiff Records. They wrote the song well before they signed with the label. And it was distributed in the UK, where not as many people were familiar with Chichi. And then about 4 months later, Devo got its big break. Warner Brothers signed the band for their first full-length album. And that, says Jerry, is when the real de-evolution began.
Okay, we've laid that whole thing out and working up to this moment. And then comes the real Devo twist that only a corporation could provide. In other words, what we're talking about, we become part of.
This new album had the very long title of Question, Are We Not Men? Answer, We Are Devo. Jerry and Mark and the others thought, since the picture of Chi-Chi worked so well on the Be Stiff single, let's just stick with it and put it on the cover of this record. The guys worked with the Warner Brothers art department, getting everything mocked up and ready to be approved for production.
And then about 2 days later, we get this call, and it's a big crisis.
The call was from the vice president of business affairs for Warner Brothers.
David Berman, who was a guy that you would cast in a movie about the music business.
As the villain or as the hero?
Well, it just depends on your point of view. He was very smart, very good at what he did, and played hardball. And the first communication is, I'm a golfer, and I'm a fan of golf, and I know Chi-Chi Rodriguez. I've met Chi-Chi Rodriguez. You cannot use Chi-Chi Rodriguez.
That is completely and totally false.
This is David Berman. I told you not everybody's memory is crystal clear regarding this story.
Not only have I never met, I have never seen Chi-Chi Rodriguez other than on television.
I'm not going to make fun of a friend of mine.
I've never met him. I've never spoken to him.
I'm not going to get this company sued.
That part is accurate, says David Berman, about maybe being sued. Yes, he did play hardball, but he says his objection was purely a legal one.
Purely. And California law is crystal clear. You can't use somebody's name or likeness for commercial purposes without their permission. It had nothing to do with my being a golfer other than because I was, I knew that it was clearly Chi-Chi Rodriguez, but it wasn't the fact that he was likable. It could have been Rory Sabatini and I would have done the same thing.
Wait, who is Rory Sabatini?
He's a golfer.
Uh-huh.
But nobody likes Rory Sabatini.
Also, Rory Sabatini was born in 1976 and would have been 2 years old when the Devo album came out. Anyway, Jerry Casale says this was a total shock to the band.
We're dumbfounded and crestfallen. We don't know what to do. But of course, we're stubborn. We're not giving up.
So Devo decides to write Chi-Chi Rodriguez a letter to formally ask his permission. But the way these things work, as soon as the record company starts spending money, they want to see a return on their investment. Plus, Devo was scheduled to appear on Saturday Night Live less than 2 months after the record was released, in August of 78. So if production was late, no album to promote. Meanwhile, the band had another idea, involving another piece of de-evolutionary art.
It's an artist rendering of what the last four presidents would have looked like had you combined them.
So Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, and Ford all mashed together. It was a picture Mark Mothersbaugh had lying around.
And it was this hideous, bizarre face that had John Kennedy's hairline, and it had Lyndon Johnson's ears and Richard Nixon's nose.
So the band brings that image to the Warner Brothers art department.
On an idea that why couldn't we just mutate Chi-Chi's face so that it isn't Chi-Chi anymore.
It was like building an old Mr. Potato Head toy. They grafted Johnson's ears and Nixon's nose on Chi-Chi's head, reversed the mouth. David Berman from Business Affairs doesn't even remember this, that the image was altered. So I sent him the original Chi-Chi image and the Potato Head collage so he could compare.
Looking at it today, I wonder why I approved it, because to me it still looks like Chi-Chi. But obviously I must have.
Jerry Casale.
And about 3 weeks later, a letter comes back from Chi-Chi's representatives.
No.
Saying, yes, Chi-Chi thinks it's fine to use that image. He just wants 50 records at Christmas time to give out to his friends and family.
He wanted to say to his friends and family, like, look, I'm on a record.
Right. He liked that.
Mark Mothersbaugh.
And so it was at that point, it's like we couldn't go back. They'd already printed the cover. So now we had this mutilated potato face for an album cover. And it didn't really look like the handsome Chi-Chi anymore. So I'm sure he was quite surprised when he got a box of them in the mail.
All our efforts were, in fact, in earnest. But what it looked like in the end is that Devo had meanly tricked Chi-Chi Rodriguez and put out something that made him look hideous. It was, you know, it was a mess.
Although, along with the records, Warner Brothers sent Chi-Chi a check for $2,500, so it wasn't a total loss for him. The band was never in touch with Chi-Chi again, except he did send Mark Mothersbaugh a couple of publicity shots of himself saying, if you want to use more pictures of me, use these. And now it's almost 40 years later, and a few questions still remain. I really want to know if Chi-Chi ever listened to that record and what he thought of it.
Yeah, that would be the big question. Well, why don't you interview Chi-Chi Rodriguez?
Hello.
Hello, Chi-Chi Rodriguez?
Yeah, who's this?
It's Sean Cole. I reached Chi-Chi at a country club, naturally, in West Palm Beach, Florida. He's 81 now, still handsome, still plays golf now and then, not professionally. Does a lot of philanthropic work through his foundation and an annual charity event. It's really an honor to talk to you.
It's my honor to talk to you, Johnny.
It's Sean, but that's okay. Chi-Chi remembers his manager getting the letter from Devo, his manager who was also from Akron, Ohio, so there was a connection there. And he says, yes, he did ask for a box of records, and he did hand them out to his friends and family. Did you notice when you got the record that it didn't quite look like you that much?
Well, it looked like me. I look at the pluses. It looked like me a little bit. At least the hat looked like me.
He didn't seem to know anything about all the mishigas that went down at Warner Brothers. Didn't know at all that they were worried he would sue them.
Sue them? Well, anybody that worries about somebody suing them, that means that they're so crooked that they sue people and they think that people are going to sue them. I thought it was these young people trying to make a career out of it, and I could help them, and that's it. Because I like to do something good every day of my life, and I want to leave the earth better than I found it.
So even young sort of avant-garde punk musicians you want to help?
Yeah.
Did you listen to that record?
Yeah, I listened to it one time.
Just once?
I put it away.
You didn't like it?
No, I didn't like it. I liked Frank Sinatra and Nat King Cole and Dean Martin, who was my favorite, you know? Because music is not supposed to rile you up. Music is something to bring you down.
So that's that big question answered. But there was a second big question that I'd had this entire time, which was, what did Chi-Chi think about his face, or a mutated version thereof, being on the cover of an apocalyptic weirdo art rock band's first album? Like, did that make any sense to him? And it did in the end. Because, of course, Chi-Chi knows he's Chi-Chi, knows how much he stands out, how outlandish and likable he is. None of that is lost on him. In fact, it's purposeful.
Golf is show business, and when you're on stage, you got to give the people a show.
Mm.
And that's what Devo did. Devo came out and gave the people a good time.
Well, so that is the similarity between you and Devo?
Yes.
So in a way, it really makes sense that they used you on the cover of their record.
I think they were geniuses. And it takes a genius to recognize another.
One could argue that...
Again, Jerry Casale.
What we were put through by David Berman actually achieved something here better than just using a found image.
So what you're saying is corporate interference plus the faces of four American presidents who prosecuted the Vietnam War and its aftermath and this wonderfully dandy-ish golf legend, all of those together.
Yeah.
It's more Devo than the original Chi-Chi image.
That's what I'm saying. It's Devo in action. Like, do you need an example of what we're talking about? Here it is.
And in possibly the most diabolical Devo twist of all, Jerry Casale, he's a big golf fan these days. Watches it on TV all the time.
One, two, three, step!
Many thanks to reporter Sean Call for spending years, not kidding, years, hunting down that story for us. Sean's piece got us thinking about the intersection of sports and music, and we figured, why not make a theme show out of it? So that's what we're going to do. Stay tuned for more musical sports stories, unless they are sporty music stories, coming up on Only a Game from NPR. I'd like to thank EMTP258 for leaving this review of Only a Game on iTunes. I used to listen to the latest episode on my local NPR station on Saturday morning, but I could only catch it if I got off work on time and only on the days after working the night before. So glad that I found this podcast on iTunes. It helps my work shift fly by smoothly and enjoyably. Thanks, EMTP258. Consider visiting iTunes and leaving a review of your own. It really is the best way to help night shift workers, early risers, long-distance runners, and commuters who spend way too much time in their cars to find our show. I'm Bill Littlefield, and it's time for three stories you should know. It's also time for the football season to begin. Didn't I say that last week? What's the holdup? Anyway, at some middle schools across the U.S., there will be no football any longer, and that's where we're going to begin this week. I'm joined by Sports on Earth's Will Leach via Skype and Julie DeCaro, an update anchor and host at Chicago's 670 The Score. Welcome back to both of you.
Hello.
Thanks, Bill.
Julie, go long. Look over your left shoulder. The pass is coming to you.
Yeah, there's been a lot of stories recently, sort of a rash of reports about high schools and youth football programs shutting down across the country. Statistically, I guess it's down about 4.5% nationwide. And obviously, there's a lot of reasons for it. Some districts have changing demographics. Or if you live out in the suburbs like I do, there are always new teams starting and poaching players from old teams. So old programs go away and new programs start up. But I think one of the issues, particularly on the heels of this huge New York Times piece they did on CTE and football, where they actually showed slices of NFL players' brains and showing, you know, talked about what had happened to them throughout the course of their lives as a result of playing football, you have to ask the question, are parents finally sorting to pull their kids out of the sport because of the threat of injury? So, you know, there's sort of a question, I guess, if this is a nationwide movement taking place right now in high school and youth football, and if schools can withstand the liability that they're undoubtedly going to see down the road if kids develop CTE.
Will, you may be the perfect man to respond to this because you live in football country. What say you?
In areas where football is incredibly popular, like here in Athens, Georgia, it is an inescapable thing. Basically, you find a lot of this has to do with wealth and with income. Generally speaking, here in Athens, in certain communities that are a little wealthier, participation is down. But in parts of Athens that are not as wealthy, it is the same as it has always been here. And I think that it's telling. There's literally a park here in Athens where on the left side of the street, people are playing soccer, and on the right side of the street, people are playing football. And I think you can tell a pretty clear economic divide between them.
40-odd years ago, I taught for a couple of years at a private school in New Jersey, and intramural football was a huge tradition. They called it house football, house against house. I've been told that recently that tradition is threatened seriously by the arrival of lots and lots of students who have no interest in playing football, not because they're afraid they'll get hit in the head or because their parents are worried about their futures, but because these kids come from countries that are so sensible that football isn't happening in them. And so it's not all about head injuries and liability. It's partly that the population is changing to some extent, and some of these people are coming from places where football's not part of the package, I guess.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail right on the head. And I think Will did as well. You know, the community that was featured in the Chicago Tribune article where their longtime football program shut down is a very wealthy, very upper middle class, very white suburb. And in the areas around Chicago that are much more blue collar, you still see football happening all the time. So I think that Will is right that there is a class divide here. And eventually I wonder if football won't be something more analogous to boxing, where you see sort of people from lower socioeconomic groups really being the main participants.
Will, I understand you want to move us along to professional football.
Yeah, it's all along the same line, though, really. It's just a step from A to B to C. You know, the NFL, as successful as it is, has a ton of issues it needs to deal with, from CTE to issues with the players' union. The league is almost kind of over-leveraged in the broadcast sector. Clearly, we're seeing changes in the way the networks work, and a lot of that money that's going to the NFL may not be there in 4 years. There's a ton of problems that are going to require a creative, inventive, imaginative mind to move the NFL to the next step. The NFL has decided that person is Roger Goodell. That is the inventive mind.
I know that name.
Yes. They decided, there's an announcement this week that his contract has been or will be extended to the year 2024, which, Bill, is literally when the next eclipse is. Like, that's what the next eclipse is. And, of course, the reason for this is, for all of these issues that the NFL has to deal with, really the 32 NFL owners only care about one, are we making more money than we were last year? And so far, the answer to that under Goodell's reign has been yes. I think we may look at this moment as one of the NFL's major mistakes, because this is the guy who, on whose watch these problems have developed and exacerbated in the first place. The idea that he will be able to solve them in the next 7 or 8 years, I think, is asking for trouble.
I feel like the NFL is sort of like the Roman Empire right before things started to go south, right? I mean, you can only get so big, and then eventually people start attacking you from all sides and the whole thing goes, you know, falls apart. I felt like last season, for the first time, we started seeing some really bad football, particularly on Thursday nights, and people started tuning out. I also wrote a piece recently saying that the only reason the sport is actually growing in fans is because of women and people overseas. So that's a real problem.
Clarify for me, growing because of women.
You know, men have started, I think, tuning out football to some extent, while there's a lot of women who are still discovering the sport who have started watching. Women are a huge factor, and not only in watching sports, but also in buying the merchandise. I think women buy something like 80% of sports merchandise, most of which we buy for our kids. So they have a vested interest in keeping women happy.
This reminds me a lot of when, like, a coach has, like, a couple good seasons and the owner gets really excited and gives them a contract extension for, like, 7 years down the line, and 3 years into, like, oh, we're going to have to buy him out, aren't we? This feels like a potential Goodell buyout situation in 3 or 4 years. I think the problems that he has kind of not helped are just going to get worse, and eventually they're going to chip away at that bottom line, and then the owners will notice.
Boy, given the numbers football generates, I hate to even think about what a buyout would cost if Goodell doesn't last the length of his contract. It would be phenomenal. Let us finish with some baseball. The Little League World Series will conclude on Sunday. This week, I visited a friend who's been watching that Little League World Series on TV. He used to coach high school baseball. He was very excited, told me some of the Little League teams that he'd seen could have beaten some of his high school teams, and he's enjoying the whole thing very much. I, however, continue to think televising the Little League tournament is a bad idea. It's too much hoopla too early, not in terms of pressure, but in terms of telling these kids, hey, something really important is happening, and even though you're 12 years old. I haven't been watching, so maybe my friend has got it right and I'm wrong. Does anybody want to stand up for 12-year-old pitchers and hitters in high def, Julie?
You know, I used to find the Little League World Series really wholesome and quite a relief from professional sports. But the more I've been involved in youth sports out in the suburbs, the more I've sort of grown to hate it and the parents and everything about it. So when I see these teams now, I feel like I'm just seeing, like, the overly involved parents, the kids who have all the resources, the ones who can travel to Orlando and Boston and California for tournaments. So when I see it from that angle, I'm really, it's not something that I'm into at this point.
Will, you a Little League World Series on TV fan or not?
One of the many things I think about when I lie in bed at night pondering the planet is how pleased I am that when I was 12, there was no internet. So therefore, all the things that I did with when I was 12 that were incredibly stupid, even stupider than the things that I do now, were not documented. Of course, anytime anything is on television at all, it's not like you're just watching it and then the moment passes. If you do something silly or you fall down or you have like a funny joke, you become a meme. I can't think of anything worse for like a 12-year-old kid to become like a meme or a GIF and have that last around forever. There was a kid. It was very kind of amusing. They asked him like if he had any like crushes as a kid. He said, oh, yeah, Miss Thompson from Homeroom. What's up? And that sounds like really funny, right? Like, ha, 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 clever. That's now the rest of his life.
I think you make a good point, but the flip side also works, and that is the 12-year-old athlete who is so much better than all the other 12-year-olds. You know, he strikes out the side every inning, or he hits 4 home runs in every game, and he might have peaked. As a 16-year-old, he might just be like all the other 16-year-olds, and as a 24-year-old, he might recognize that maybe he should have gotten a degree in accounting instead of tried to play baseball for a living. It's kind of, you know, that builds up that expectation of something glorious and eternal, and it isn't glorious and eternal for most of these kids, even if they're really good Little League players, I think.
That's a really depressing thought. The idea, you know, we've always had people always trying to relive their high school glorious athletic days. Now we have people in high school trying to relive their 12-year-old
glorious high school athletic days. Because they're on TV.
That's kind of sad.
My guest for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know, which, I'm sorry, does seem to be ending on a bummer, have been Will Leach of Sports on Earth and Julie DeCaro, an update anchor and host for Chicago's 670 The Score. Thank you, both of you.
Thanks, Bill.
As always, an honor.
This is our lovely way. The parents of former Major League pitcher Barry Zito may have fallen in love to a Nat King Cole tune. Could have happened that way. They were both working for him when they met. Barry's future mom as a backup singer and dancer, and his future dad as an arranger and conductor. Barry was born after his parents had left the Nat King Cole Orchestra. The family moved to San Diego, where, according to Zito, though the weather was great, the opportunities for his dad were limited.
There was no music industry, so my father then didn't have really an outlet creatively.
So dad was in the market for something to do, and young Barry gave it to him, T-ball.
He didn't know a whole lot about sports, and so he would read these baseball books at night by himself, and the next day we would go through a couple pages, and I would learn all these things. And, of course, I thought he knew the whole book in and out, but really, he was just a couple pages ahead of me.
Those must have been some baseball books. Barry Zito became a heck of a major league pitcher, won a Cy Young Award, but I'm getting ahead of myself. While he was still a kid, Zito got some career advice from his father, the musician, who taught him nothing about music.
He actually didn't want me going into music. He knew how difficult it was to make it in the music world, and his approach was always, you know, you master three pitches, and baseball will send out these scouts to the ends of the earth to find you. Whereas you could be the greatest musician ever, but if you don't have the right people behind you pushing you and the right machinery, you may never go.
Still, the Nat King Cole connection must have been lurking somewhere in young Zito's psyche, because after the scouts had, in fact, come looking for him and the Oakland Athletics had signed him, he figured correctly that as a minor league ball player, he'd have a lot of time to kill.
I wanted something to do while I was going to be stuck in these hotel rooms and on these bus trips. So I got a signing bonus and I bought a guitar. You know, just started learning how to play a couple chords.
Barry Zito's ascension from plunker of chords to semi-competent sideman happened during the off-seasons, courtesy of his sister, who'd embraced her music heritage, gotten a degree from the Berklee College of Music, and started performing.
So I kind of really upped my game to be a part of her band.
Meanwhile, Zito had been upping his other game, the one his father had taught him so he wouldn't have to be a musician. He made his major league debut in 2000 with TAs. He won that Cy Young Award in 2002. And in 2006, he signed with the Giants for $126 million. No pitcher had ever signed for more. So he should have been on top of the world, but he wasn't.
You know, you kind of get boxed in, I think, as a professional athlete to a certain stereotype. A lot of times, I think my whole career, I felt a little bit out of place in a locker room. And I would say things that, you know, we're probably a little bit different, or maybe making myself more vulnerable than most. And, you know, I got labeled as flaky or eccentric. If you don't fall right into that stereotype, you know, now you're just kind of an outcast.
Some of his teammates were happy enough with what they'd achieved and were achieving. Zito wasn't.
Generally in society, we're raised to worship these idols, these false idols, I guess you could call it, of, you know, money, fame, adoration, success. But for the people that do get some of that stuff, you realize it's empty. And what was I shooting for this whole time? And I think there's a sense of despair once you realize that it's not there, it's not in that.
The despair, if that's not too dramatic a term for what the multimillionaire pitcher was feeling, was fed by Zito's failure to live up to the expectations created by that record-breaking $126 million contract. Zito lost 30 games in his first two seasons with the Giants, winning only 21. San Francisco fans started booing him. He was called a bust. At the end of the 2010 season, he was left off the postseason roster. San Francisco won the World Series without him.
It was a very painful time for me that offseason in L.A. And I think part of me just wanted to get away from baseball. And I went and recorded with a few friends at this really great studio in Burbank. I would wake up and train from like 7 to 11 for baseball, and then I'd go right to the studio in my sweaty athletic gear up until about 10:30 at night.
During the next season, Zito wrote the song Home.
The spotlight told lies, I bought every last one. I traded family and friends in for fortune and fun. But then it all crashed down as I swung my wrecking ball. Waiting in the aftermath was the reason for it all.
No wonder he'd spent such long hours in the studio. Finding reasons for it all can't have been easy. Meanwhile, his wife was concerned. She told him to slow down. There would be plenty of time for songwriting after baseball. And Zito took her advice, and his state of mind improved. He also credits his faith. It all worked, and in 2012, he went 15-8 and won games in both the National League Championship Series and the World Series, which meant he had a World Series ring he really felt he'd helped the team earn. He pitched for a couple more years, finishing up with Oakland's AAA team in Nashville, which was spectacularly convenient.
I started co-writing here in Nashville literally the week that I retired. And haven't stopped since.
I may not know the secret to life, but I know what it's not.
I think I'm just genuinely more in love with what I do now than I probably ever have been.
Meaning, I suppose that if you're a professional musician and you have a kid, you should probably steer him toward baseball, since that's the path that will eventually lead him to a happy life in music or something.
We're all under attack and we need answers fast. Yeah, we need them fast.
Barry Zito's EP, No Secrets, was released in January. It reached number 39, according to Billboard Country Album Sales. And that made Zito the first Cy Young winner to appear on the Billboard charts.
But I had to try. Yeah, the world's got a seat on time. I saw it once, it was
in the 1970s, Sweden's top teenage musical sensation had a secret talent not many of his fans knew about.
He played tennis very well, and he even, I think he beat Bjorn Borg once. That's what people tell me.
That's just ahead on Only a Game, and you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
Hi, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and hang on, don't hit that double fast-forward arrow for a second, because I want to tell you about another WBUR podcast I know you're going to love. After all, it's called Modern Love, and it's a collaboration between WBUR and The New York Times, featuring true stories of love, loss, and redemption, performed by noteworthy actors.
In any marriage, even the best marriage, there will come a day when you wonder why you married this person.
She's dead to me, I told my friends.
Why did I throw away the best thing I ever had? I wrote in my journal. Please, God, bring her back.
It's easy to love the beautiful, the normal. But what about the gifts of loving the strange, the uncommon, the odd?
Modern Love, the podcast from WBUR and The New York Times. Subscribe right now on your favorite podcast app for a new episode every week.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, a four-time NBA All-Star finally finds peace behind the counter at Starbucks. But right now it's time for my conversation with Charlie Pierce about the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
On Tuesday night, a trade further energized an already lively NBA offseason. The Cleveland Cavaliers get Isaiah Thomas, several other players, and a draft pick, and the Boston Celtics get Kyrie Irving. Do we see Thomas scoring 52 against the Celts on opening night, or does Kyrie Irving torch the Cavaliers?
I don't know. I think you're going to see Isaiah Thomas try to get 52 against the Celtics on opening night. I'm fairly sure of that. Obviously, it was a gigantic deal. A lot of people's opinion of this trade depends vitally on how good you think the Brooklyn Nets are going to be next year.
Because
there's a draft pick there that could be valuable or could be meh. I think it's a wash, really. The one thing that makes me nervous for the Celtics is that they've lost a lot of their best defensive players in the offseason. On the other hand, you got to remember, and I think a lot of people forget this, Kyrie Irving's only 25 years old.
Yes, exactly.
And they've got him on a pretty decent deal for a guy of his caliber. So I'm saying it's a wash.
The Dodgers are enjoying a terrific season, Charlie, except for pitcher Rich Hill on Wednesday night. Hill had a no-hitter going through 9 innings, which is generally enough, but his team hadn't scored any runs either. Still, you have to give Hill credit for blaming himself rather than his teammates for what happened in the 10th inning.
Yeah,
right?
He gave up a home run and lost the game. Yeah, this is one of those things. I mean, this is just, you know, there's the legendary Harvey Haddix game.
Absolutely.
There's the Galarraga game, which was lost on a bad call. You know, Rich Hill's been a real effective professional pitcher for a long time. I hope he can enjoy the memory of the first 8.5 innings, though.
August is almost over. Are you ready to predict who's going to make baseball's postseason? And beyond that, which team will succeed the Chicago Cubs as champion? And wait, I don't really care about your prediction. I just wanted to say Chicago Cubs and champion in the same sentence.
One more time. I actually like the Astros. I think the Astros can do some damage. Their pitching's a little bit weaker. They got to get through the Indians, who are probably the best team in the American League. The Red Sox continue to be extremely weird. Pretty clearly better than every team in their division. But, you know, incredibly up and down. You know, wheeling and dealing still. I like the Astros. You want an outside pick? I will pick the Astros to win the World Series.
Jets fans have reason to rejoice, I guess. This week, Coach Todd Bowles announced, and I'm quoting, "We're not going to be a terrible team." I know it's the Jets, but was that really the best you could do?
First of all, he's wrong, okay? That's the worst part of the thing. They are going to be a terrible team.
Oh, dear.
But I don't think it's very reassuring for Jets fans. The best the coach can do before the first game of the year is, "We're really not going to be terrible."
It would only have been better if he said, "We're not going to be a terrible team. Get your tickets now."
That's right. Yeah.
ESPN made a noteworthy staffing decision this week. They pulled an announcer by the name of Robert Lee from the University of Virginia home opener and assigned him to another game instead. ESPN said they were worried about Mr. Lee's safety. Others say their reasoning is silly. What about you?
Their reasoning is silly.
I agree.
I mean, I'm not going to make a big political thing out of it because, you know, major media corporation makes questionable personnel move is not a scoop.
It's not big news.
It's not a scoop, right. No. But apparently they did it because they were afraid that evil people on the intertubes were going to make fun of them, which is really a stupid reason to do anything, as I've learned.
We don't often talk about the sport of swimming, but I think what professional swimmer Fernando Alvarez did this week demands attention. He asked the officials at the World Championships to observe a minute of silence to honor the victims of the terrorist attack in Barcelona. They said no, so Fernando Alvarez paid his respects all by himself.
He stayed on the starting blocks
exactly.
For a minute before he dove in. I have never seen a gesture quite like that before.
It's extraordinary.
It's really wonderful. And it's probably the best thing to happen to Barcelona sports this week, as you were about to bring that up.
Earlier this summer, speaking of Barcelona sports, Neymar, the talented and accomplished soccer player from Brazil, left FC Barcelona to play for Paris Saint-Germain. This is good for fans of Paris Saint-Germain. It's even better for lots and lots and lots of lawyers, as I understand it.
Barcelona is suing Neymar for breach of contract. They're not going to pay him his 26 million euros in bonus payments he was supposed to get this summer. It's a mess, and this is a franchise that generally doesn't have messes like
that. And he's suing them back.
And he's suing them back,
right.
Exactly.
Plenty of lawyers
and
involved.
And here we go. Just when you think, you know what this controversy needs? The involvement of FIFA. Neymar has reported Barcelona to FIFA over the unpaid renewal bonus he was due this summer. FIFA, I'm sure, is figuring out how to get a piece of that bonus. That football team over there is swindling me.
Right, right.
Let me bring in better swindlers.
Yeah, they did have a guy who was known as Mr. 10%.
Yes.
So, yeah. And finally, Charlie, 53-year-old author Malcolm Gladwell, famous for lots of things that he's written and said, is apparently not satisfied with that. He wants to challenge LeBron James to a race, and he has proposed a mile as an appropriate distance. You want to make some odds? Give me a line on this if it happens?
I mean, I'm an educated man, Bill, but I don't know Malcolm Gladwell's athletic ability, so I'm not going to make any predictions.
He claims to have run a 5-minute mile at some point.
When, though? I mean,
I
he's 53.
That's
I mean, did
true.
He run it last week?
Couldn't tell you.
But, I mean, if you could arrange this for charity, I'm not entirely sure LeBron James wouldn't do it.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time, and, of course, he joins me each week on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Our hour of sports stories set in music is coming to an end, but we have one more tale to offer, an encore, if you will, and it comes to us from Stockholm, Sweden. Now, you might wonder at first where the sport comes in, but it's coming, I promise. Here's reporter Tom Henley.
2 years ago, I moved to Sweden with my girlfriend Amanda, who comes from Stockholm. We were driving around one day, and she asked me, "Do you want to listen to a song?" And I say, "Yeah, of course." And then she asked me, "Have you ever listened to Ted Gärdestad?" Ted Gärdestad? I'd never heard of him. And Amanda says, "You've got to listen to this one song." And so she slides in a burnt CD, and the song starts playing, and I start listening. And I was hooked.
När jag ser dig, då slutar jag tänka. När jag hör dig, då hettar min kind. Kanske vill du att jag ska få längta när du försvinner som en sommarvind.
The name of the song was Helena, and as soon as we got home, I started wondering who Ted Gärdestad was, and who, come to think of it, was this Helena he was singing so passionately about. I got obsessed, and then I found this.
Thank you. It was a time when it seemed that the only name people knew from Sweden was Abba.
It was a bit embarrassing.
It was lovely, really, but it's a relief and a pleasure to welcome from Sweden Ted Gärdestad.
That's Agnetha Fällskog and Frida Lindstad standing on a ski slope in Switzerland, introducing Ted in one of their TV specials. Apparently, before they were ABBA, Agnetha and Frida had backed Ted.
It was a black night, cat night, hell of a night.
But eventually, my life in Sweden started to find its own routine, and I gave up trying to find out more about Ted and Helena. That is until recently, when I heard the song on the radio again, and it all came back to me, I decided that I had to find out who Helena was. And what I found was a tragic story involving one of Sweden's most promising young musicians and a championship tennis player named Helena. First, I listened to the lyrics carefully. The song is about Ted falling in love with this Helena, but not knowing how to tell her, and so it struck me that he must have known her, as a friend maybe. I started to track down those who knew Ted, and I found this guy.
My name is Janne Schaffer, and I'm a guitar player, and I also write music. I met Ted in 1971 through his producers, which was Björn Ulvaeus and Benny Andersson.
These were the other two members who would one day make up ABBA. They were told to look out for new talent, and in the end, they found a 15-year-old kid called Ted, who'd been composing his own songs from the age of six.
That first album came out in 1972 and was called Wanderings. We were very happy. That was a very happy recording, and we found each other, Ted and me.
Ted quickly became Sweden's first teen idol. He was a household name up and down the country as his albums went gold and he made one hit record after the other. But he had a secret talent that not many people knew about.
He played tennis very well, and I think he beat Björn Borg once. That's what people tell me. Helena Olin was a rather famous Swedish tennis player. I think she was also involved in Björn Borg, I don't know, but he dedicated that song, and it's a fantastic song.
I started looking all around Sweden for this Helena Anliot, and I came up empty-handed. I realized that if I was ever going to find Helena, I'd have to look further afield. I never realized how far I would have to look, though. In the end, I tracked down Helena all the way in Australia.
My name is Helena Anliot.
Helena's tennis talents were discovered at a young age, much like Ted's musical talents had been.
There was a man who was a professional ice hockey player that came from Czechoslovakia. He was a political refugee. His name was Zabrodsky. He was traveling around in the countryside and looking for talents. He was looking at the boys, but then my father asked if they could throw me in, and I was about 9 or 10 at the time. Zabrocki, he said then, this is the future champion, he said. I totally loved it.
And so Helena worked on her game and got better and better. Cut to the US Open in 1977.
My ranking was high at the time. I was ranked 32 in the world at the time, and I was number one in Sweden. I beat Marzikova in the second round, and then I moved into playing Chris Evert.
Now, Chris Evert was one of the best tennis players around at that time. By the end of her career, she would win 18 Grand Slam titles.
And I lost 6-2, 6-2, but it was a close game, and I had lots of chances. And after that game, I felt that I'd really done well, and that I, you know, for the future, I felt that, you know, I can even do better next time. When I was at the height of my career, which was probably in 77, I contracted glandular fever.
In the States, glandular fever is better known as mono.
And that basically finished my career, even though I tried coming back. You train to perform at your top level all the time. Like, that is the tennis player's life. And when you just underperform all the time, it feels so meaningless.
Tennis is still a big part of Helena's life, but grandchildren and art have taken over. But I wondered how she met Ted and what she thought about that song.
Me and Björn Borg, we were going out from when we were pretty young, you know, from about maybe 16 or something like that. And I knew Ted during this time, but Ted and I, we got together a bit later on. We spent enormous amount of time together, and we very close spiritually. So we were just talking our way through days and nights, and yeah, it was lovely.
Eventually, Ted and Helena broke up. They stayed friends and kept in touch for a while, but lost contact when Helena moved to Australia. It was only later, after they had broken up, that Helena heard the song that Ted had written about her.
I was really surprised when I heard the song, and I didn't even know whether it was for me or anything, but I was hoping. Yeah, that's how it was. I found out later, though. It took a few years until I found out that he actually wrote it about me.
Jana Schaffer, however, remained a close friend with Ted, playing on most of his records, and he told me all about Ted's life, a life that started with such joy and hope, but ended so tragically. Jana started to see a change in Ted's mental condition in 1981, when Ted went out to America to escape the fame back home in Sweden.
When he decided to go to Oregon, he was tired of being an idol, and everybody recognized him, so he wanted to do something else. And after that, it became a little change. And then he came back to me in 1992, I think, and asked me if I could help him to do a new album. But that was something else. It wasn't the same Ted as from the beginning.
After this album came out, Ted toured extensively for 3 years. People saw it as a comeback for the kid who had once topped the charts in the 70s. However, tragedy struck in the summer of 1997. Ted, aged 41, jumped in front of a train in the central station of Stockholm and committed suicide.
I was very, very sad and was very tragical. But I wasn't 100% surprised, because I had known, I had a feeling on the last record that he had some very dark side. His wanderings in the lyrics in the last record was not happy at all. So I wasn't totally surprised, but I was very sad.
Helena was living in Australia when she learned of Ted's death.
I heard that he was mentally unwell, and we didn't make contact in any way, you know, before he died. If I can wish for something, you know, I'd
yeah,
really like, if you can play maybe just a little bit, if you have time, is I Dröm och Fantasi by Ted. I love that song.
I found it fitting that Helena had asked me to play this song and not the song that had brought me to her in the first place. I Dröm och Fantasi is a song about fantasies and dreams and how fragile they can be. Ted's dream came true. He found fame and respect with his beautiful songs, but in the end, he couldn't outrun the sadness inside him. Helena, on the other hand, had to say goodbye to her dream of becoming a tennis player, and her time with Ted has become just a story she tells her grandchildren.
Som I en dröm blev kroppen lätt och jag svevade mot skyn. Jag fick vingar, stora
That's reporter Tom Henley. He produces a podcast called Saga. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our senior producer is Karen Given. Our final word comes from pitcher-musician Barry Zito, who tells us about the dark times in his life.
You know, I was a bit destructive when I was single and I was living in L.A. and putting a lot of eggs in the wrong baskets, you know what I mean?
Sure, I get it. Eggs, baskets. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.